I was always grateful for my time with survivors and hearing their stories. It gave me a real texture for how this crime is committed. But it was my conversations with traffickers that perhaps gave me some insights into how they think about this crime and how we can actually work to stop them.
Hello, and thanks for listening to I Love Cincinnati, a podcast that showcases the people who are building and affecting change in the city. I'm your host, Chuck Mingo. And before we get to my guest today, make sure you listen to the end for a chance to win a $200 gift card. Today, I'm interviewing Ambassador-at-Large John Richmond. Ambassador Richmond doesn't have the normal job description that you'd think of when you hear that he works for the State Department. You may think about foreign countries and trade deals, but in this case, the Ambassador-at-Large deals with one specific piece of foreign and domestic policy, human trafficking. His work with trafficking didn't start with his ambassadorship. He's done everything from being a federal prosecutor to working with the United Nations and even spending 3 years in India working with the International Justice Mission. He's a freedom fighter. And the ambassador recently visited Cincinnati and took the time to sit down and talk over his work, his faith, and what our city is doing and can do to combat human trafficking.
My name is John Richmond. I currently serve as the United States Ambassador at Large to monitor and combat trafficking in persons, which is an incredibly long title.
Yes, it is.
In Washington, D.C., the amount of influence you wield is disproportionately related to the length of your title.
So the longer the title,
the less influence you
have. I get it. Okay.
You know, most people don't realize what an ambassador at large is. When we think of ambassadors, we think of ambassadors in residence. You're an ambassador to a specific country on a wide variety of issues. But there are six ambassadors at large in the United States. That is, ambassadors not to a specific place, but to all places. But instead of being on all issues, just one specific issue. And I'm really excited that the U.S. government has elevated trafficking in persons to that status.
So, how recently is that? Has that position been instituted in the U.S.?
Yeah, it started in the year 2000, so okay. It's relatively new. I'm the sixth person to hold this position. I'm very grateful that all the prior ambassadors are folks that I've met. Many of them are friends of mine. We were actually all just together in June for the release of this year's Trafficking in Persons report, which I think gives this great sense of continuity, that this is an issue that's bipartisan or apolitical, that people from all different perspectives can get around it, because it really goes to the dignity of individuals.
That's exactly right. And as you know, here at Crossroads, one of the places we've been deeply invested is in the anti-trafficking work in places like India and other places in Southeast Asia. And one of the things that I've learned through that is just how big of a challenge and a problem this is. And I know you're going to help us unpack that today, but we should start at the beginning. So tell us how you got into this space. What got you or maybe opened your eyes to the idea and the issue of trafficking?
You know, when I was practicing law in Virginia, I was at a law firm doing commercial litigation work. I had the opportunity to travel to India and China, get to look at what was going on in the world with some friends. And about that time, there was a young nonprofit organization called International Justice Mission, and it was just getting started. Mm-hmm. They needed a lawyer to go to India to do forced labor and slavery work. My wife and I thought about it. We prayed about it. We were trying to consider what would make our careers meaningful. And I was absolutely struck by the idea that I could use my degree and my experience practicing law to actually advance the cause of justice around the world. So I had absolutely no experience. I had no basis to go to India and try to do this work. I knew nothing about slavery or human trafficking. But we went and we learned and we were able to build a team that could begin to do these cases.
Mm-hmm. So talk about, you know, those first couple of years or even months and days there. What was it like? What was it like just getting into a different cultural context for sure and then tackling this issue that was really fairly new to you?
You know, India can be an overwhelming place if you're not oriented to it. And it certainly was. My wife and I and our 15-month-old daughter went. My wife was pregnant when we went to India and our second child was born there. We learned how to live life, how to kind of develop in this new cadence and rhythm of learning. It was fantastic for us to begin to see the United States from a different perspective. as well as to get to learn another culture. And while we were doing that, we were learning Indian law and Indian criminal procedure, trying to figure out how do we identify victims? Right. What does that look like? And slowly but surely began to meet individuals who were victims of forced labor, mm-hmm. and hear their stories, listen to what they went through, document with their ordeal, and then begin to try to mobilize the government to take care of the situation. That is to enforce Indian domestic law to protect its citizens. Mm-hmm. But I found most remarkably that I began my journey of getting to know traffickers as well and spending time with them. And I think both our 3 years in India, as well as the 10 years that I got to prosecute human trafficking cases at the federal level in the United States, I was always grateful for my time with survivors and hearing their stories. It gave me a real texture for how this crime is committed. But it was my conversations with traffickers that perhaps gave me some insights into how they think about this crime and how we can actually work to stop them.
Well, that's pretty wild. So, I mean, I want to hear stories, maybe the most meaningful stories that kind of tie that together for you. But you talked to traffickers. I would imagine that they knew you were a lawyer, mm-hmm. and they knew that you were trying to prosecute them.
Yeah.
And yet you're saying some of those conversations were the most profound for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the context of it, so, you know, sometimes it was we were doing undercover work in India. When I was at the Department of Justice, it was certainly after they had pled guilty or in the process of deciding to plead guilty and testify against their fellow traffickers. But they would be candid many times, and we'd walk through how they chose to commit this crime, how they targeted individual victims, what they were looking for, how they determined what type of coercive scheme to apply, and what their perspective was about risk, what their perspective was about whether they would ever get caught.
So, I mean, the question, you talked about how questions, and I'm sure that those were enlightening. Did you talk about why? Why do they traffic?
Yeah, absolutely. And the answer to that is in two parts. The number one reason that they would identify as their motivation for trafficking was to make money. Mm-hmm. It's an economically motivated crime. We think of it as a crime against someone's fundamental human rights, but that's not how traffickers see it. Mm-hmm. Traffickers just want to exploit people to make money. Mm-hmm. So that's their articulated motivation. It's what they tell their victims. It's what they tell others. But underlying that is a second reality. And that is that they fundamentally don't believe that people have inherent value. Mm. They don't see individuals as worthy. They don't believe that individuals matter. And because of that, they can treat people as if they're a commodity.
Yeah, man, that's powerful. So I know you, I've heard you talk before, and you talked about a specific, I think it was a woman who was trafficked, and just how powerful her story was in your journey in this work. I don't know if you're open to sharing, maybe that story doesn't come to mind, but any stories that come to mind that you could share of a person who's been on the other side and having been trafficked, what did you learn from them?
You know, what I've learned from survivors is resiliency. Is how resilient they can be. They've endured all different types of trauma, all different types of coercion, and the fact that they can continue to live, continue to survive, continue to cling to hope. And I think one thing that we can bring to victims around the world is this sense of hope, that there really is a future for them. Mm-hmm. Traffickers are constantly telling them there is no future, there is no hope, that they do not matter. And we get to reverse that script. We get to take direct aim at what traffickers are saying by reminding people that they're worthy, that there is a future. And I think, you know, survivor after survivor that I've gotten to know have struggled with that reality of really what their identity is.
Yeah.
And it comes back to that fundamental question of, do they matter?
Yeah.
Are they defined by the worst thing that's happened to them or the worst thing that they've done? Or are they defined by something else, mm-hmm. something greater?
Yeah. Man, that's a powerful... That's just true for all of us to some degree.
Yeah.
Obviously, because of the trauma, they're dealing with it more directly. But just the worth of the human individual and where we draw our source of identity and worthiness from is such a powerful perspective. And it sounds like you've experienced that in this work. Now, I know for a fact, because we have a mutual friend, that you talked about your time in India and you kind of gave us the headlines, but it was not easy.
Mm.
You had some serious challenges to even doing this work, and the words that come to mind when other people talk about you are relentless resilience, that you were relentless in this work. So talk about particularly your time in Chennai and all the things that people told you would never happen, and yet they happened.
Yeah, I can tell you that many folks, when we were leaving to shift to India, to move there, were basically telling us that we would never succeed at this, that there was no way we were ever going to be successful, that the problem was so massive and so great, and we were so inexperienced and had no basis of knowledge. And what they were really telling me was just that experience mattered. And what I realized really quickly was that it was experienced people that built the Titanic, and it was amateurs that built the Ark.
There you go.
And, you know, I don't think that experience always has a better track record. What I found, though, is that if you find
Can
people—
Can I just stop you? What also is so good about what you just said is I think a lot of times when there's a big problem and it's daunting— It's easy to say, well, I have to wait until I get more experience. I have to wait till I'm ready. I have to wait till I know more. And what I hear you saying is sometimes the most inexperienced person who's willing to just go after it can actually make a lot of difference in an area like this.
I think that's right. And let me just caveat that to say it doesn't mean that we go in unthoughtfully. It doesn't mean we don't have a plan. It doesn't mean we don't get prepared. It means that we don't keep waiting to act.
Yeah.
You know, we take action towards what is right and what is good. And so, you know, we certainly had some challenges. When we were in India, there were certainly challenges in terms of learning how to operate. There were challenges in my wife's health after the birth of our second child, sidelined us for quite a while. We learned to be dependent in ways that we never wanted to learn. Definitely learned that our wit and our wisdom and our intelligence were not going to solve this problem. There had to be something more.
And what did that look like? What did you have to depend on, or what did you depend on?
You know, for us, coming from a faith background, we certainly depended on God. We certainly depended on our relationship with Him. We also learned, though, that community was critically important. And for us, community meant building a team, finding talented young individuals who were willing to step into this work. And one after one, we met these great friends who were willing to come on, risk everything, and do this work. You know, it's interesting because last week I got to go back to India for the first time in many years. And we were in Kolkata. A couple of my friends, team members from our work in Chennai came up, and there was a bit of a reunion. And we were remembering stories. Stories of raids that went unsuccessfully, stories of police that had been corrupted, but also stories of individual victims who were thriving and doing well.
Yeah.
There was one case right after the tsunami, which was an amazing experience in and of itself, but after the tsunami, we did this investigation into whether people were more vulnerable and whether folks were, traffickers were operating in the context of that vulnerability.
Because all the infrastructure had been destroyed, everybody's kind of, you know.
Exactly, exactly. We set up an investigation. We did this undercover sting with Indian police officers, and a mother tried to sell two of her daughters to a group of foreigners for kind of a sex party at a fancy hotel. The mother was arrested by the Indian police. The daughters were given some protective care. Years later, I think it was 7 years later, I actually testified in that case over closed-circuit TV from Washington into the court in Tamil Nadu. Ultimately, the mother was convicted, but you know, when we had this reunion last week, they got out their phones and they showed me a photo of this young woman who they tried to sell us so many years ago, who was now a nurse.
Wow.
And she had a family, and she was living into her best version of herself despite what her mother tried to do to her.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, honestly, there are people who have been saved by the work that you've done.
Well, certainly by the teams that I've gotten to be a part of. You know, it's never about an individual. And I think it's important in this work to remember that none of us are essential towards it, but all of us are important. You know, in holding that tension.
I like that.
That, you know, I think that a lot of people can get burned out very quickly because they think that they're the only person that cares, or they care the most. And people can end up with a savior complex, that they're out there trying to do this work and it all depends on them. And I think the reality is that we are all a mist and a vapor. We're here today and gone tomorrow. But this work is meaningful. And for the days we have to get to work together on it, to get to bring this this truth about human value and justice into the world, is a great way to spend our time.
John, I've never had this experience. I don't know if you knew that or not. I've never been called by a president and asked to do a job. So, you know, it's a unique experience. And I just wonder, so when you get that call, What goes through your mind as you thought about stepping into this role? What were the things that you were thinking about? What did you want to accomplish? How did that all play out?
It was a surreal moment, I will have to tell you. The first thing was when they were trying to explain to me about what the job was, and I was thinking, I actually know that what this job is, because my predecessors, who were the prior ambassadors, are friends of mine, and I watched them work, and I worked through this office at the State Department in the past, and I knew how talented the team was that that did this work. But I was really happy in my job. I was leading an organization called the Human Trafficking Institute with a couple of great friends. We were doing meaningful work. And the question was, do you step out of this for a temporary job, particularly in an environment where politics is involved?
Right.
You know, what we ultimately decided was that there was so much opportunity to try and drive this message about freedom around the world. To get to lead U.S. foreign policy on human trafficking around the globe, mm-hmm. to get to be a part of the United States State Department, to have access to that information and to those individuals was an opportunity that we just couldn't pass up. And we thought if the Senate was willing to confirm me, that we would do the job. And fortunately, for whatever reason, after my confirmation hearing, they did. They yes. confirmed me at the end of October.
That's so cool. So you take this job, and I'm wondering, you know, as you think about the current landscape of the United States, what would you say about human trafficking in the United States today? Because I think it's important to recognize that while you are certainly helping us as a country think about what our policy is in places like India and in Bangladesh, this is a challenge and an issue right here in our country as well.
Absolutely. There is trafficking in the United States. And I think one of the things that people don't realize is that it does happen right here. You know, one of the helpful statistics out there is that the International Labor Organization estimated that 77% of victims around the world are trafficked in their country of origin. To say it another way, that traffickers are exploiting 77% of all the victims right where they live.
Right.
That they're not crossing a border. They're not moving to another country. They're not taking them to another place. Mm-hmm. And that means that we need to address not just transnational trafficking, but we need to address internal trafficking.
Yeah.
So they're victims here. We need to care for them. They're victims of labor trafficking as well as sex trafficking. They're adults and minors. They're citizens and non-citizens. And if we're going to take this issue seriously, I think we have to address all forms of trafficking mm-hmm. and not just cherry pick one or two forms that we want to focus on,
yeah.
But really be about this idea of freedom for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And the cherry picking, I'm assuming, is because some of them are easier to talk about because they're not painful, but people perhaps have more of a heart toward them. And I think some of this is invisible to us as Americans.
I think that's right. It's easier for us to identify, in the United States at least, mm-hmm. Sex trafficking
right.
cases
right.
because we've criminalized the underlying action, that mm-hmm. is the selling of commercial sex.
Mm-hmm.
What we haven't criminalized are cleaning crews that are cleaning up big box stores
right.
at night. We haven't criminalized dishwashers in restaurants. And because that's not illegal, and because when you see someone washing a dish mm-hmm. in a restaurant, you're not overwhelmed with emotion, thinking that is immoral, that
right.
is wrong, this
mm-hmm.
must stop. We have to go another question deeper. We have to ask, how are they doing that? How did they get this job? Are they free to quit this job and go work somewhere else if they want to?
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, who's blocking them? Who's stopping them? We know that most of the trafficking around the world is forced labor,
mm-hmm.
And we want to make sure that we begin to address that more seriously in the United States. The State Department puts out a report every summer, the Trafficking in Persons Report. We rank 187 countries around the world. We provide narratives about how they're doing around prosecuting traffickers, protecting victims, and trying to work to prevent this crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's dismantling the systems that allow traffickers to operate. The number one recommendation for the United States for the last several years has been to increase the number of forced labor cases.
Hmm.
And those numbers are not going up.
So prosecute it more. Find it and prosecute it more.
Absolutely. What we need to do is sort of three simple things on the first tranche of this. And that is, we need to identify victims, we need to provide them initial stabilization services, and arrest their traffickers.
Hmm.
We need to do those three things over and over again. That's not everything.
Right.
Like, we still need
right.
long-term, comprehensive, trauma-informed care.
Mm-hmm.
We need to think about supply chains. We need to think about recruitment fees. There's all sorts of bigger policy issues. But I think it's driven from the beginning of just identifying victims, getting them stabilized, mm-hmm. and arresting their traffickers.
Is it it fair to ask this question? I don't know if you can answer this or not, but where is this working well in the states? As you think about, because I would imagine some of this is certainly national, it's federal, but then some of this gets down to states or cities or honestly probably places where organizations just care enough to make sure that things are getting done. So what are some of the success stories you're seeing as you do this work?
Yeah, I think I would divide that into a couple categories. Success stories in victim protections, I think, are localized. You're thinking about where do we have good services to provide to victims, both those initial stabilization services as well as longer-term care. We've seen all sorts of different models be successful. Some are long-term shelter programs, some are job skillings programs, some have tattoo removal, some are focused on how do we help people deal with the trauma and unpack that over time. What we've learned is that survivor engagement in the forming and structuring of those programs is really helpful because all survivors are different.
Right.
Gone are the days where we need folks to come in and say, we're going to build a sewing center in India, and then all the victims should go work there.
Right.
Like, not every victim wants to be a seamstress. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, what if we get to know the victims, figure out what their needs are, what trauma they experienced, and how can we help them build their lives into freedom?
But that just sounds like a lot of work. That sounds like you can't just have broad systems that work for everybody to do that, John.
It has to be relational, right? We actually have to get to know people.
Yes.
And instead of asking survivors to conform to our pre-existing programs, we're going to build programs that focus on them as individuals. Mm-hmm. We're going to have tailored individual care plans. Yeah. And where we have seen folks do that, it's been really successful.
Yeah.
But it also means we have to be open to the idea that the things that we're doing to program may not service all victims. Mm-hmm. That we don't have to, each individual NGO doesn't have to be all things to all victims.
Right.
Which means that maybe a different NGO
would
be better, and we can collaborate across models. And so I think there's some freedom in that. There's some opportunity.
Yeah.
And certainly having survivor engagement, survivor leadership has been incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I just want to be clear, not to have survivors just tell their stories.
Yeah.
Right? That can feel a little voyeuristic for the audience. Like, why are we just sort of like catching a window into their trauma?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we want to ask survivors to be engaged so they can share their opinions.
Yeah.
Share their hopes about their future, share what they didn't like about the way NGOs were providing care or the way law enforcement treated them during the process, and make recommendations about how we can all do better in the future.
That's really good. I want to define a term. You've used it a couple of times, NGO. So what do you mean when you say NGO?
Yeah, it's one of the most useless acronyms ever, right? It's a non-governmental organization, which is really useless because, like, everything other than the government is an NGO.
That's true.
But we basically co-opted this acronym now to basically mean what we used to call nonprofit organizations.
Okay.
In many places, we call it civil society organizations. It's groups that are operating, trying to care for victims that are not directly related to the government. Now, they may get funded by government grants.
Right.
We'd love to see governments do more and more of that.
Yeah. And as you say that, it makes me recognize a lot of the work ultimately happens through these kinds of organizations.
Absolutely. I think that, and it should, quite frankly. You know, it's communities coming together for community-based solutions.
Yes.
Trying to think through how can we work together to care for our fellow man and women. We want to see more of that. There are limits to what government can do effectively.
Yeah. I think that's so important because, you know, the title of this podcast is I Love Cincinnati. And one of the things that I've learned is so many of these challenges do get down to working together relationally at a city level. And there are things we can do. I mean, obviously, there's a place for government and there's a role for government. And there's also a place for people in a city to say, we're going to come after this. We're going to come around the victims of this. We're going to be relational in that way. And as you talk about the need for customization and kind of knowing the victim and knowing what is going to work for them, it takes me back to what you said. In some ways, I think if we're not careful, we can do the same thing on the healing side of this journey that was done on the trafficking side, which is forget the dignity of the human being, forget their worthiness and their value. And so I hear you really raising that as important in the work that you do and that you want to see done.
Absolutely. I think it is fundamental, and it's always good to anchor ourselves back around that why. Why is this wrong? That it violates that human dignity aspect. And so I think it helps us make sure that we're not just customizing it, but we're also finding that common humanity, that we're respecting individuals enough that we're going to treat them so that they have agency and they get to make basic decisions about their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
That we want every individual to decide when they wake up in the morning, where they work, and who touches their bodies.
Well, and so you're here in Cincinnati because of things that are happening locally. So really thankful that you were able to make some time for us in the podcast. Talk about why you were here in Cincinnati, and if you could, just give us a lay of the land of Cincinnati. What did you learn or what are you learning about how this work is happening locally here?
I was so encouraged to be invited, first of all, to get to come to Cincinnati. We met with a group of NGOs, nonprofit organizations that are working in this space, around a round table, discussing kind of what their challenges are, what they're seeing. Groups that are focused on sex trafficking and recovery around that, folks that are interested in labor trafficking and making sure that individuals who are undocumented get respected through this system. Worked that was focused on coalition building around the community that's focused on anti-trafficking in the city. And I was incredibly encouraged, both by the ideas they shared, but also by the energy in the room. You know, before we got started, I was just watching everyone as they were hugging each other. They were connecting. They clearly knew each other. I was coming into a community that had a long history.
Cool.
They knew each other. They cared about each other, and they want to make things better.
Man, that's really cool to hear. Because, like you said, I mean, community is so important. And I just recognize in any kind of work like this, the courage really comes from community. I don't think anybody can maintain the courage to do the kind of work we're talking about, injustice, if you don't have the community supporting you. Other people who are trailblazing ahead of you, some people that you feel like, man, they're coming behind me, and so I need to stay strong in that place. And then peers that you can talk to and really get an understanding of. So what did you guys talk about in terms of Cincinnati specifically? Is there anything you can share with us around that?
Yeah, I think that Cincinnati obviously has a robust group of organizations that are focused on this issue. We've got law enforcement here in Cincinnati that are focused on this as well. There are good things afoot here. One of the things we talked about, though, was the importance of being in this for the long haul. That trafficking is not an issue for which there are kind of easy fixes, simple solutions, or silver bullets. Yeah. That this is a long, grinding, difficult work. And sometimes it goes slowly. But it's worth pursuing. Mm-hmm. Because even though it's a long-term project, we want to make sure that we're in it to the end. Mm-hmm. There are many people who start in this space and few who finish.
Yeah.
And what we saw is there's a lot of people in Cincinnati that want to be finishers. Mm-hmm. They want to be the people that get to the end where we really see a change. And although it's not full of short-term fixes, there's a ton of hope that good things can happen and that we can make a huge difference.
Yeah. So you have been a starter, and it sounds like you want to finish strong as well. So talk to us personally, as a leader, how do you keep yourself energized for this work?
You know, I think it's an incredible question, because self-care amongst the individuals engaged in any sort of difficult, long-term, protracted cause is important. For me, it comes from a couple of things. One is remembering that I'm just not that important. It's understanding my place in all of this. Whereas I think my work matters, I'm not essential to this project. I mentioned before that sort of I'm a mist, I'm a vapor, I'm here today and gone tomorrow, and this will continue with or without me, which frees me up from the responsibility that I have to do it all.
Yeah.
Right? It takes some of the pressure off and just allows me to work hard on my piece today, what I'm supposed to be working on. That is helpful for me. It's also helpful to draw from my faith in terms of encouragement, my community in terms of encouragement. And then I'd say the resiliency of survivors, watching individuals that have truly become friends who are living their lives and not always well. They still make mistakes, which is really what we wanted. We wanted them to have the freedom to choose,
which means
they may not always choose well.
Yeah.
But boy, is it important to have that freedom to make sure that individuals get to do that. You know, at the State Department, we talk about this idea of freedom first, that freedom really does come first. Until you are free from your trafficker, until you have the ability to make the most basic decisions about your life, all the other freedoms don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Until you're free from a trafficker, you're not free to assemble to worship.
Yeah.
You're not free to gather with your friends. You're not free to exercise your right to speak what is on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
That this idea that we want to make sure we're bringing up the topic of freedom first. We want to bring it up with governments. We want to bring it up with leaders. We want to draw people into this movement, because it's not just a movement about ending human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a movement about bringing a culture of justice to the world.
Yeah.
You know,
define that, man. When you say that's powerful. So what define the culture of justice? What do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, I can tell you that when I was in college, I remember my philosophy professor bending himself into an intellectual pretzel trying to understand what justice is.
Uh-huh.
You know, the truth is justice is simply making wrong things right.
Yeah.
It's seeing something wrong and working to make it right.
Mm-hmm.
Local things and global things, small things and big things. We want to be people that are seeing wrong things and making it right, whether it's seeing a piece of litter on the ground, mm-hmm. picking it up, putting mm-hmm. it in the trash can, mm-hmm. whether it's for middle school students, you know, shifting to that table where no one else is sitting with
sure.
that new kid, making that wrong thing right.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's reaching out to that elderly person in your neighborhood who you know is lonely and would just want someone to sit and have tea mm-hmm. and relive stories from the past.
Yeah.
You're fixing a problem. You're mm-hmm. making wrong things right. On a larger scale, it looks like dealing with issues like human trafficking.
Yeah.
This idea that we have 24.9 million people in the world that have been sidelined by traffickers.
Man, is that the number?
Yep, 24.9 is perhaps the most conservative number.
Yeah.
And that is more than ever before in human history. That's more individuals than were trafficked during all 400 years of the transatlantic slave trade.
Wow.
It is a big number, and that gives us this sense of urgency.
Uh-huh.
We need to go do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to pair our sense of urgency with a sense of doability, right? Because
okay.
I think you can get really overwhelmed just by a big
right.
number and
right.
a big problem. What can we do? It seems intractable. But the reality is human trafficking is not something we're powerless to have an impact on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's not like a weather
yeah.
pattern. It's not like an earthquake. We're powerless to stop earthquakes.
Yeah.
All we can do is mitigate the adverse consequences mm-hmm. of an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So an earthquake happens in a country, we rush in with tarps and kerosene and bottled water. We're trying to help people survive through that disaster. But trafficking's different. You know, we're not powerless to stop it on the front end.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we're not just left trying to mitigate the adverse consequences of exploitation.
Yeah.
We can actually move upstream and stop trafficking at its root cause,
yeah.
which is the trafficker,
mm-hmm.
which is the individual that's making this decision to profit by exploiting someone in labor or commercial sex work.
What would you say to the person who's hearing this? And maybe this for them is an awareness moment. Maybe for them, they're like, gosh, I don't know that I understood it to the degree that you've talked about it. It makes me wonder about the things that I'm buying. It makes me wonder about some of the places maybe where I'm, you know, engaging with people here in our city. What would you say to that person in terms of a next step they can do?
I think the next step is to start educating yourself,
okay.
to become aware, to become informed, both internationally as well as domestically, and see where are the obvious next steps that arise.
Yeah. Right?
It's going to be different for each individual.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you interested in? Where is the intersection of your new interest in trafficking and the need of the world?
Yeah.
And then begin to step out into that.
That's really
it could
good.
Be caring for individuals who are recovering, who are getting support services. It could be coming alongside the police and just encouraging them.
Yeah.
You know, I think so
yeah.
often we just leave the police out of these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But they're individuals who are working difficult jobs under stressful conditions. To advocate for more resources, mm-hmm. for specialized units that might be able to focus in on this crime, to make sure that they are getting the resources that they need. It could come in a number of different directions,
yeah.
but I would keep moving towards that goal.
That's really good. So we wanted to just leave some time here for you to kind of address whatever you wanted to say. I mean, you obviously get to talk about this in a bunch of different contexts. You have a sense of our city. What do you want to say to people as kind of a final word on this?
Now, the thing that I believe is lacking most in our work to combat human trafficking is a sense of hopelessness. I think that we need to bring a sense of hope, not just to the victims, which is critical, but I think we also need to bring hope to the population that's going to do something about this. I think a lot of people hear about trafficking, they feel emotionally overwhelmed, they don't know quite what to do next, and it just seems overwhelming. And so I think there are lots of different arguments for why we should have hope in this space.
Yeah.
But one I'd love to end with, which is an argument from history. You know, for the 4,000 years of recorded human history, there has almost always been some form of human trafficking or slavery. And it's looked different on different continents
mm-hmm.
and in different cultures. But from the Incas and the Aztecs, the Greeks, the Romans, the Hebrews, the Chinese, the Indians, it has been around. And it's expressed itself in a variety of different ways. But what I find overwhelming is that it has been democratically approved. It's been legally endorsed. It's been religiously endorsed. It's been culturally accepted. And we're at a place now where things have changed. About 220 years ago, we saw one by one countries begin to pass laws to abridge the slave trade and then ultimately emancipate victims.
Yes.
And now we're at a place that every single country in the world has some sort of law against trafficking. And so if you expand that out to like your high school history teacher's timeline of history, you've got 4,000 years of recorded history, and then this little sliver at the end, the last 200, where we have this grand consensus, where we have all of these countries coming together to say, this is illegal, which is amazing.
Yes.
You know, our
yes.
Constitution in three places affirms slavery democratically.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's an unbelievable scar on our nation's history. But we have this grand consensus now. We have leaders of every major world religion saying that their sacred texts no longer support trafficking in persons. We've got diplomats and parliamentarian and congresspeople that have come together to give us this legal framework, which is an incredible accomplishment. And I think we can look back and be incredibly grateful to them for that. But now we're at this place where it's about implementation.
Yes.
It's about a delivery system of justice.
Yes.
We have to take these parchment protections of law and extend them to the people they were intended to protect. The survivors I've gotten to know are not desperate for another UN resolution.
Yeah.
Like, they're not desperate for another sense of Congress or another amendment to an act. They just want their pain to stop.
Right.
They want the laws as written to be applied equitably.
Right.
And so we're at this massive inflection point. I think we're at this hinge of history. And I believe the door of freedom is poised to swing wide.
Yeah.
And the question before us is, are we going to be the generation that pushes that door forward and lets freedom come to the millions of people that are oppressed?
Wow, that is a right, worthy, and honestly, that's a noble challenge. That challenge is worth giving your life to. As you were saying those words, I'm hearing the soundtrack of Hamilton and the song History Has Its Eyes on You.
Yes.
And in some ways, what you're saying is this generation, us, we're in the best position in history to end this now.
No doubt about it.
Man, that's encouraging. And I want to encourage you. There's a scripture in the New Testament, and it says, because of this hope, we are very bold. And as I think about your career and what you've done in this area, I see that it's been fueled by a hope that you said yourself comes from your faith, comes from the community around you. And man, you are very bold. So it's been a pleasure and an honor to get to interview you. Ambassador at Large, John Richmond, thank you for the work you're doing. And thanks for being on I Love Cincinnati.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Awesome. I Love Cincinnati is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. This is our last episode for the season, but we plan on coming back near the end of the year. We already have some great guests planned, but we want your feedback. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at I Love Cincy Podcast. That's I Love Cincy with a Y Podcast, where we will post a link to a survey, and you can give us your thoughts on the podcast so far and recommend future guests. And just for giving us your feedback, you'll have your name entered into a drawing for a $200 gift card. Thanks for listening. See you in the next episode.